Recording. Welcome to the August 15th, 2023 regular session of the Island County Board of Health. The first on our agenda is any changes to the July 18th, 2023 regular session minutes. If there aren't any, we'd entertain a motion. If there are changes, we'd entertain a motion with changes.
To the agenda or the minutes?
To the minutes. I don't know when we do the agenda. I'll do that next.
Oh, you have a different piece of paper than I do.
Oh, welcome. Any changes? All the order. I did that. Are there any additions or changes to the agenda? I'm working off my own page over here. Sorry.
Nope.
Okay, the agenda is good to go. Approval of the minutes.
Second.
Motion by Commissioner Wallen, second by Commissioner Bacon to approve the minutes. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Next up is public input or comments. Just a reminder that we try to limit public into it to about 3 minutes, and your comments need to be directed to the board. Is there anybody who wants to speak with us today? Anyone who's, yes, good, online.
Yes.
Could you my glasses aren't good enough to see your name. Could you stay?
Mark, my name is Mark Wall. Did you want me to start now or do you, yes. I do want?
No, yes, please, Mr. Wall.
Okay. I'm Mark Wall, director of CLEAR on Whidbey. CLEAR is an acronym for Citizen League Encouraging Awareness of Radiation. And that's the EMF kind or the RF radio frequency kind. It's a pollutant just like smog, lead, or PFAS. Last year, CLEAR successfully led the affordable, efficient implementation of a state-of-the-art wireless telecommunications code for the city of Langley, an action that has become a template used by at least 4 other cities in the nation and is being studied by other counties, including Island County, but lagging quite a bit. Electromagnetic sensitivity is a very real affliction suffered as a serious handicap by at least 1.5% of the population, and a lifestyle-changing disability by up to 5%. Consider that 1.8% of people have peanut allergies that inspire whole protective programs. Meanwhile, EMF pollution is now increasing exponentially and is being driven by completely profit-driven by big wireless that actually admits they do no health testing. I have provided Sean Morris with a lot of information about the reality, dramatic increase in symptoms of this condition. A widely watched EMF situation right now is in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, of all places, where citizens practically overnight found that a tall cell tower had been quietly approved by city officials, built and fired up with virtually no citizen consultation. Many citizens were outraged when they saw this appearing, and 17 very injured citizens, EMF injured citizens, bombarded the Board of Health with requests to investigate it. Fast forward 2 years, and there's a lot of detail here, but anyway, after months of careful research, the board issued a nationally unprecedented cease and desist order to Verizon. This is unheard of, a whole Board of Health standing off with Verizon to remove the tower. Their 25-page order is deeply informative, and I've given a copy to Sean. I'm happy to give it to anybody else. It's very informative on the whole issues I'm trying to talk about. Pittsfield had a poor, outdated wireless code, making the fight hard. That's also the case in Island County. Island County has a 6-page antiquated code. Langley's new code has over 40 pages to meet today's tech complexities. Now our own Camano Island is the site of a Pittsfield-like problem. An Idaho wireless developer working for Verizon recently announced a 150-foot tower construction plan contracted with a local landowner. This shocked some local radiation-sensitive residents who had recently moved to that exact location, assuming a low radiation area. My communication with them and research on the project has revealed carelessness of the operator and several gaps in the authenticity of the operator's requests. It's an uphill climb to call these out due to poor Island County ordinance weakness. Is there truly a gap in Verizon coverage? We don't know. They aren't compelled to say. Have they considered all possible tower locations further away? Hard to compel that. Is this tower location absolutely the least intrusive way to fill their communication gap, which they haven't even proved exists? can't find it out, the code doesn't ask for it. It's important for the health board to be up on EMF issues. I provided much info to Sean and hope he can share it with you. And I'm available also to provide info. Your expression of urgency to the planning board to place in their September docket a wireless code update would be appreciated, as they left it off last September despite much prompting. That's my message to you as a health board. I'd really love to have that, this EMF more in your consciousness. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. That was good information. Is there anybody else for public comment? Anybody passionate about anything they want to share? Okay, we'll close the public comment period. Is there any response that anybody wants to make, or we'll just direct that to staff for follow-up? Okay, then we have
nominations
for membership of the CHAB. We've got Taylor. You want to do the presentation? I'm doing that so I don't mispronounce anything.
Yeah,
save me from myself.
Actually, I will probably need to ask for forgiveness and pronunciation as well. So So I'm very excited, actually, just overall with our response from the community and being engaged in the CHAB. So I want to acknowledge that and celebrate that. So thank you to our community for that, and CHAB specifically for getting the word out. Our first nomination is for Michelle Cato. She, I'm just going to read if that's okay with you all.
That's perfect.
Okay. It is with my pleasure that I recommend Michelle to the Island County Board of Health for appointment to sit on the Island County Community Health Advisory Board. Ms. Cato has served as an executive director in Haiti, Guatemala, and China, and led programs in AIDS prevention, family planning, harm reduction, private provider system improvement, and maternal and child health. She has since held multiple leadership positions as listed here in consulting and business ownership. Ms. Cato is currently the Executive Director of Island Senior Resources. And then just to go on down for the sake of time, Ms. Cato's vision for a healthier future for Island County is a thriving community in which the most vulnerable among us are seen, valued, engaged, and served equitably, and those less vulnerable demonstrate understanding and empathy of those less fortunate. I am pleased to recommend to the Island County Board of Health the appointment of Michelle Cato to sit and Island County Community Health Advisory Board as a representative of the healthcare access and quality sector.
Do we have a motion to appoint Ms. Cato, or do we have any questions?
I'll make a motion. I actually represent my country. I'll second the motion, but she's got a cockapoo dog. I noticed that, so.
Well, we've got our priorities straight up here. We've got a motion from Commissioner Wall and a second from Mayor Severance to appoint Michelle Cato to the Community Health Advisory Board. Is there any further discussion? Again, great addition. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries unanimously. And Fee Mishko.
Thank you. Yes. Fee Mishko, it is with my pleasure that I recommend Fee to the Island County Board of Health for appointment to sit on the Island County Community Health Advisory Board. Ms. Mishko has lived on Whidbey Island for 14 years. Her spouse serves in the Navy and they have 3 children. She has dedicated her time to the community and its organizations, as you can see from this list to follow. She has served on a multitude of boards and held leadership positions in partnership with multiple local organizations. Trying to sum that up a little bit. Lots of training experience as well, as you can see. Ms. Mishko is the shelter manager for Spin, Spin Cafe, very strong partner in a lot of our work here at the county. And she's worked at Spin for 2 years, assisting guests to connect them to resources that help them transition out of homelessness. She plans to continue her service to her community by recommitting to the CHAB. Her vision for the healthier future for Island County includes access to more mental health and wraparound services, youth-involved programs, and lower cost of housing. I am pleased to recommend to the Island County Board of Health the appointment of Fee to sit on the Island County Community Health Advisory Board as a representative of the social and economic sector.
Do Do we have a motion to appoint Fee Mishko or any questions for Taylor?
I move to appoint Fee Mishko to the CHAB.
We have a motion by Commissioner Bacon, a second by Commissioner Wallen to appoint Fee Mishko. What did you
say? Mishko.
Mishko? I've been saying it wrong.
Yes, apologize. Sorry,
I led you astray there too. Is there any further discussion? Is there any question? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Unanimous. Good work, Taylor.
Thank you.
Those were good additions.
Awesome.
Now we have the ever excited consolidated contract amendment number 14. Sean, I bet this is you.
Yes. So we have for your review consolidated contract amendment 14. And this relates to our foundational public health services or FPHS funding, as well as in revising and adding a few statements of work for our immunization promotion, on-site sewage, recreational shellfish, and Office of Drinking Water Group A programs. This is a larger amendment, and it's a renewal of our proviso from last fiscal year of around $1,600,000 for the foundational public health services. And we've had discussions with the board and the Board of Health throughout the past year on use of this funding and in planning to bring back to the board an kind of impact discussion of different services and programs funded with this. It really touches nearly all of our programs in public health. We have funding through FPHS that supports our environmental health programs, our food safety, our maternal child health, injury prevention, communicable disease. Everything we do is supported in some way by FPHS funding. So we'd like to bring back a more detailed discussion and look at the year ahead. As far as the Group A systems, this is expanding funding to continue to provide sanitary surveys. The on-site funding relates to our local management plan. All Puget Sound counties have a local management plan or LMP that guides different technical requirements and outreach activities for our on-site program. And it may be worthwhile to bring that back to the board for a deeper discussion around our on-site. And actually, oh, perfect. So our EH manager, Heather Cordrum's sharing that actually bringing that to the board as a requirement as part of our LMP. So that will be coming back around as well. And then this extends funding for our recreational shellfish activities where we're providing hazard notification to the community on shellfish safety. And I'm available to discuss and any questions. There's an executive summary that outlines the funding as well as the complete details of the funding in the packet.
Are there any questions for Sean? Of that 1.6, how much of that is flexible funding and how much of that is targeted, directed funding where we can brainstorm all we want, but that money's going to specific programs?
Yeah, great question. So $684,000 is what's considered general FPHS, which is a shift from last year. Last year, that was called reinforcing capacity, and it was about $275,000. And then they pulled out some of the specific allocated funding that was for our communicable disease, some for EH, and they put it into this general fund. So of the general, we have, and we can bring this back to a discussion, but it's allocated to somewhat to finance capacity, EH programs, and the entirety of our communicable disease program. And then there is room for discussion. There is
like $600,000 room, or you're telling me that of the 684, the millions committed, mm-hmm. of the 684, there's still funding in that that's directed?
Yeah, well, it's directed towards, to our communicable disease program, a lot of it is allocated.
Sean, how much money does this board get to brainstorm with? You're telling me like $300,000?
I think I'm thinking not just of that general fund, but we've had discussions about community health funding and our life course funding, which is for chronic disease, injury prevention, and maternal child health. and Linda of Human Services, we've had discussions about some of that funding. If there's room for brainstorming, I think about $80,000 to $100,000. And of this funding, of the 684, I'll bring it back to the board. It's fairly tightly allocated, but we can look at it all together and determine, and the board can determine.
Okay. Because, I mean, you got a room full of people who see new money, and we see a lot of community need. Right. So immediately we're going to take that money and try to solve problems. So I just needed you to limit my brainstorming to reality. I don't have $1.6 million of brainstorm.
Unfortunately, no.
Okay. And by the way, it's not just me you don't want to turn loose. We got Bob, Melanie, and Ron here. You're nice.
But there's some room for brainstorming, and there's funding on the way that will also, there'll be room for discussions around allocation.
Okay. Sure. Are we
looking for a motion to approve this amendment today? Okay, and then you'll come back to the board with how some of that's going to be spent.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to the board with a discussion of services and programs funded through FPHS. Partly it funds community partnerships as well, and also share those Senior Falls Coalition, that work.
So I noticed this requires a budget amendment. Is that standard for pretty much every amendment?
For us it is, because we're, as public health, we're taking in new funding throughout the year, especially with the ramp up of these FPHS funding.
But it's over our budget. We would have normally budgeted for that.
That's
now, this is far enough over that we needed.
Well, this money is a replenishment of money that was previously allocated. So essentially we haven't had, it's the, for the FPHS, we're not adding new funding yet. There is new funding on the way, but this is replenishing the money we had from last year. And then it will be, it's woven into our budget for 2024. If that answers your question.
You make a motion?
Yeah, I'll move to approve amendment number 14 to consolidated contract number CLH31012.
Second.
We have a motion by Mayor Severin, the second by Commissioner Bacon, to approve consolidated contract amendment 14, contract number CLH31021 (14). Is there any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That one's unanimous. Now we have a presentation from Jason Vogel from the University of Washington. So that's going in the right direction on Earth Lab. And Sean, do you want to set this up?
Or? Yeah. So yeah, we have Dr. Jason Vogel.
Oh, doctor.
Dr. Vogel is the interim director of the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington and has over 20 years of experience working in climate science and adaptation, as well as experience working with municipalities and consulting, working both domestically and internationally. And we'll be providing a review of the In the Hot Seat report, which is detailing the health effects of heat in Washington, and including a discussion of heat-related illness and mitigation strategies. So I'll do a screen share here.
Or we can wing it. Wait a minute. There it is. Okay, good. Oh, tap your arrows. That, yeah, I want to put smudgy fingerprints on there, but it's not okay. It's all yours. All right. Thank you. All right, thank you for having me, and look forward to conversation. I was invited to speak with you all about extreme heat in Washington State. So about a year and a half ago, some of my colleagues and I We're just reflecting on the heat wave in 2021 and what a severe event that was, and decided to dig in, you know, in some pretty deep detail to really understand what was going on, what made people vulnerable to illness and death in that event, and quantify it, but really to focus in on what can we do in the future to kind of prevent that sort of thing. So you've got a list of the collaborators here. So I'm with the Climate Impacts Group, but we worked with collaborators at Gonzaga University. They've got like a foot in Eastern Washington, so it's trying to be statewide, the State Department of Health and others that you see up here. You know, is go to the website listed there to look at the full report if you're interested. We also have a like a front and back cover one pager with our full list of recommendations and like overall insights. So you can listen to what I'm saying. You can not read a word of the report and just read that one page, and you get the vast majority of like what we learned in this time frame. And it's in English and Spanish as well. So if you've got Spanish language community members, they can read this as well. So at the Climate Impacts Group, we've often played this role of sort of bringing science to the people, digging into the deep details of, you know, 1,000-page Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports and trying to figure out what does it really mean in Washington State, and putting them into small digestible reports with some good figures that really help people to understand it. But this effort wasn't really meant to be that, right? We do some science in it, and I'll discuss it a little bit, but it's really meant to be more like this other effort from a long time ago in 2007, where it was really focused on what do folks in a position to make decisions need to know about what we can do differently to reduce deaths from extreme heat. So that's really what we're going to talk about here. Our hope is really that this will focus on what can be done about extreme heat, who needs to be involved to get that work done, and ultimately how we can work together to save lives. So since over the last couple of decades, this is a, you know, you don't actually need to know anything about this report, because I just want you to look at that one row. But this is a recent publication by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that's just showing that we are starting to observe these impacts. This is not particularly surprising these days. We just have probably all heard the news about what's going on in Maui with wildfires. We're currently seeing smoke outside from fires in North Cascades. There's a lot of stuff in the news about the impacts of climate change. And this is just showing that, the world scientists have looked across different regions. What I've kind of squared off and read there is showing what's happening in North America. Very high confidence that there is significant impacts of climate change on all of these different ecosystem features. So the changes in species, the range of species, freshwater and saltwater species. And then a similar chart, and there's North America again, that just shows that there's also a lot of evidence emerging that we're already seeing these impacts that climate is having on human systems. So health and well-being, our water systems, our infrastructure are all being impacted by climate change. And so that just sets the stage for what, you know, maybe fast forwarding past all of the debates about, you know, how many Teslas should you own, or is mining for the lithium the wrong thing? It's really more focused on what is it that we can do on the specific topic of protecting public health from extreme heat. So 2021, in that year, this is a graph showing you on the bottom the number of deaths attributed to extreme heat. And on the top, it's the number of all-cause deaths, excluding deaths from COVID-19. And we've circled there that heat dome event from, I think it was June 28th to July 3rd, June 27th to July 3rd of 2022. And it's that, you know, it's that big spike. You can really see this coming out. And, you know, more people died each day of that event than normally die in an entire summer extreme heat in Washington State. So it was a huge outlier in terms of its impacts on public health. According to our analysis, 441 people died above and beyond what we would normally expect in that time frame, right? So there's different ways of looking at how people are impacted by heat. And it's not just about deaths. I'll get to that in a second. But deaths is like the one thing where it's really impactful, right, to the families and people who are affected by those deaths. But when you look at all cause deaths, you know, people die from more than just heat exhaustion or heat stroke. There's exacerbations of kidney disease or cardiovascular failure. Accidents tend to go up in extreme heat events. Drownings tend to spike as people are trying to get to cool water to cool themselves down. And we have pretty cold water sources in Washington state. So you can get a lot of cold shock, you know, so the listed cause of death might not be heat. So if that upper chart gives you a little bit of a better sense of what was the real impact, it's not just the number of people who we say on the death certificate basically died from heat. It's all of these other people that died for all the other reasons that are implicated in that event. So that makes it the worst weather-related disaster in Washington state history, that 2021 extreme heat event. And really kind of a wake-up call for, I think, for all of us to think about how to handle this. It's not something that Washington state has had to handle a whole lot. We've had a pretty comfortable environment for a long time, but nor is it impossible, right? There are people living in, I grew up in Houston, Texas, right? I don't like going back to visit in the summer, but people live there year-round. There's ways to exist, survive and thrive in hot environments. And we can kind of learn from those experiences. But I do want to say beyond sort of you can write these graphs and show these graphs of deaths, which is an easy thing to do. There's actually a lot of other parts of the story that are important. Extreme heat causes adverse pregnancy outcomes. There's the Center for Disease Control found a 69-fold increase in emergency department visits in our region during this time frame. So that's putting stress on our hospitals during a time where they're already stressed and you know have low staff issues. The Seattle King County 911 system had the highest volume of calls in its entire history. I think it was founded in 1968. So now our EMS responders are also being overtaxed by this event if we're not preparing for it. And estimates from NOAA's National Centers on Environmental Information looked at like what are the costs actually, like the lost labor productivity, but actually when you shut down air traffic or various things that are going on, you total it all together. And the costs, economic costs of this event were likely in excess of $1 billion for this 1 week of extreme weather event. So a lot of reasons to care about it, right? And I think deaths is the easiest one to wrap your head around, but there's a lot of other important things in the mix. So yes, the 2021 heat dome was extraordinary and we can anticipate more of those ahead. There'd be, you know, it was an extreme event. Those things happen now and then. The question is, what does our understanding of climate change suggest we should be looking forward to and preparing for in the future? Here's a couple of graphs. The right-hand side one comes from our report where we historically we've seen about 3 extreme heat days in Washington state per year. And so this is just looking at how many extreme heat days are we likely to see moving forward by looking at a couple of different climate models. So it's the little lines there. So you can, you know, there's different reasons for believing different models, but basically what it shows us is that if you look out into the 2050s, we're going to be looking at somewhere between 17 and 27 extreme heat days on average, compare it to experiencing 3 now, and that's pretty bad. Today, maybe one of them, you know, felt pretty hot as I was walking over here. But we had some in May, right? Like the seasons in which this is happening are expanding in both directions, which is catching people off guard, right? That event in June that killed so many people was partially so deadly because we weren't thinking about how to protect people in June. We were really thinking about how to protect people in July and August, right? So we can expect this to increase in frequency in the future. A lot of that's sort of baked into the system. It's just happening. And I don't think it's a huge surprise because the news has been full of this. Like the entire southern part of the United States has been in this extreme heat situation for, it seems like, months on end. All my family that's still back in Texas is shooting me pictures of their dashboard thermometers and not wanting to get out of their cars because it's like 112. And it's, you know, it's just really unpleasant. On the left-hand side, that chart, what that shows you, it's a free tool that we host on the Climate Impacts Group website that allows you to look at how extreme heat days will evolve over a geographically spread area. So instead of just Western Washington and Eastern Washington, which is the two graphs in our report, you can actually get a finer sense of where it's getting hot and where it's not. As you can imagine, you hit that Cascade Crest and you're not seeing a lot of extreme heat events along the Cascade Crest. nor does anyone live there. So we really don't need to worry about those zones. Pulled up a point value there, you know, some spot somewhere in, if I had had more time, I would have picked a spot here in Island County, but sorry, you got a spot in King County there, where you can just, you can do the same thing here and see how many days are we expecting to have those extreme heat events. So we've got a lot of information, but basically it's all pointing in the same direction. There's going to be more of these events. So we should start preparing for them now. The good news is that we really know what to do. This is where I was saying a lot of people in the world, but we can just focus on America, live in places that are hotter than Washington State. They've already figured out a lot of the things to do. We can learn from them. A lot of them haven't done it well, so we can learn from their mistakes as well as their successes. We got a set of three panels I'll share here that are just like illustrations of some of the things you can do in different environments. So you're looking at, you know, an urban area, and a lot of urban areas have, you know, relatively less shade. They tend to have lots of asphalt, you know, dark colored roofs. They absorb a lot of heat, and it's known as the urban heat island effect. Many of you have probably heard of it before. These are also tend to be places where you concentrate more vulnerable populations. So you get this double whammy of having more exposure to heat, but also often populations in trailer parks or people who live in, you know, near commercial or industrial zones that are you know, more vulnerable to begin with. So you kind of see this, like, you know, left side panel is maybe our worst case scenario, or maybe it's our status quo. On the right hand side, it's what are the kinds of things you can do, and that includes looking at tree planting campaigns, green roof or white roof ordinances, ways to reflect more of that heat. Providing shade shelter at places like public transportation stops. These are small things, but waiting outside in the heat's a big deal. If you just provide shade, that's a very vulnerable spot. You know, for places that have some, you know, itinerant or unhoused populations, having people doing outreach, getting out there and helping them, just providing water can be a big deal. Providing places to cool down. So in this case, we just illustrated the mall, say open late, you know, incentivize people to go to places they want to go already. Not sometimes people focus in on the, you know, we need a cooling center, and there are ways to make that work, but sometimes you end up with cooling centers in a place no one wants to be. So there's a lot of nuance to this, but this just gives you a sense of there's this wide swath of things that can be done to help reduce the exposure or sensitivity of these populations. Unfortunately, very little of it is under the control of health departments. And that's one of the big complications we'll get to that at the end, is like this involves like decisions made by departments of transportation, land use planning departments, different sources of funding at the state level or federal funding that's being funneled through state agencies. It sometimes involves private actors as well as nonprofit actors, as well as the government space. So there's a lot of challenge in addressing this issue. And I'll say more about that after I say a little bit more about solutions, because that's the good stuff. Another one here, right? You've got some of our most vulnerable people are the elderly. People, and by elderly, I don't want to use that as a negative term in any way, but people over the age of 65 are just statistically more likely to experience negative impacts from extreme heat. They're more likely to have other complicating factors like cardiovascular disease or renal kidney disease that are pre-existing conditions that make them more vulnerable. Many of them are on fixed incomes and don't have a lot of money to solve problems, or they have mobility impairments, so they can't go to a cooling center or the mall or someplace where they could cool down. Sometimes they don't have anyone checking in on them. You know, their family may have moved away and they're kind of on their own. So, you know, it's a particularly vulnerable population. In this illustration here, we're just kind of showing, you know, left-hand side, maybe a kind of vulnerable situation if they're in older housing. On the right-hand side, things like installing air conditioning units or heat pumps if we want to stay more carbon friendly, but then making sure people can afford to use them. There's a lot of research out there of people that have these kinds of systems in their homes and they won't use them because they can't afford the electricity bill. But you can also do simple stuff like putting shades on windows, planting trees outside of those south and west facing windows can really cool down a home, a place where somebody's staying. The phone's ringing there to try and get a sense of, you know, checking in on these people. And I'm not sure a phone call is enough. It's just symbolic of sometimes you need to like go there, knock on the door with maybe it's some water. Maybe it's some knowledge of ways to cool yourself down. Putting a wet washcloth on your neck is a really proven way to cool people down quickly. But you know, one of the things we learned in that 2021 heat wave is you think about, well, we need to reach out to these folks in the heat of the day because that's when it's really the worst. But the reality is that that heat isn't coming down very much in the evening, especially in urban zones. And so it's not enough to check on them in the heat of the day. You need to come by in the evening too, because that now they've been sitting through that heat for a while and these buildings aren't cooling down and they're still suffering, right? So kind of expanding that outreach network is pretty important. One more here for sort of outdoor workers. And, you know, we've illustrated a farmer here, but construction workers are in the same boat here. People that work on, you know, on fire crews also face the same thing. But there's a lot of research that has shown how to help these folks. Some of it's shifting working hours, right? Most people think of a working day as like 9 to 5. But you know what? If it's going to be blazing hot in the middle of that time frame, we might need to shift those working hours in ways that prevent people from getting endangered, providing hydration, shade. Some stuff seems strange, but it's really effective, like making the bathrooms closer to where people are working radically increases the usage of hydration facilities by women in particular. So there's information out there that can really help us understand how to serve more vulnerable populations. And I don't know as much about Island County as all of you do, so I don't know which of these things is most relevant, nor have I illustrated everything that's in the report, but this gives you a sense of like the you know, sort of combination of different ways people experience heat and are vulnerable, and also this portfolio of solutions, which gets me to just a quick look at, you know, in the report, what you'll see is...
Stop you from
Sure.
Back.
We'll go back. Yeah, I saw a look on your face that was like, I don't like that picture.
I really don't.
Yeah.
Have you given this presentation a lot?
A few times, yeah.
And nobody's given any feedback?
On this picture? I'm ready for it.
I feel like farmers can be lots of colors and not necessarily look like migrant workers. And I'm a little bit concerned about your color choice. And I don't mean to be dramatic about it, but we went through our training and it said, if you see something, say something. And I feel like you talked about farmers, but the photo implication is migrant workers. And the idea there is that our low pay workers must be Hispanic, right? I used to pick strawberries. I'm not Hispanic. So I'm just putting it out there, something maybe to be sensitive to, because it kind of feeds into, it made me uncomfortable.
I appreciate your willingness to open a challenging topic. And I feel like the more that we can talk about topics like that, the more we're putting useful information out into public spaces. So I didn't make the drawing, so I won't claim credit or blame, but I did allow it to be published. So I'll fall on that sword. But what I can say is that extreme heat has outsized implications for people of color, that when you do look at the total population of people engaged in all forms of outdoor work, it's disproportionately people of color. It is a lot of migrant farm workers, as well as people of color working on construction crews. So I don't think that the choice of a colored person was meant to be a negative thing, but a representative of a reality that we face, which is that these populations are more exposed to extreme heat than some others.
I think that's fair feedback, and I understand. I just want to make sure that.
No, say it. Yeah.
I don't want to validate my, you know, natural, I don't know, bias, right? That's who's out there, but it is fair that's the truth. So.
Yeah.
In many instances. So that's fair. It's fair that that's the population that's impacted largely.
Yes. And, but nonetheless, I still appreciate, because I'm in a position where I'm dealing with these issues all the time. And it's not easy to ask the question. And I appreciate you asking the question. I'm also glad I had an answer that wasn't really embarrassing. Okay. But yeah, I saw that look on your face. I knew it was coming. So and there's some of the details I was able to say out loud, but the picture doesn't really describe, are in the report, right? Where we, you know, have, I think we've got 9 of these individual sort of actions that can be taken, and we summarize them pretty succinctly. You know, what is it we're saying you should do? Usually we have a case study, an example of where it's been done in another locality. So here you're looking at increasing tree canopy and shade structures. We've got a little The example is in the bottom left. You can't see because the writing's so tiny, but it's a policy from Chula Vista, California. And what we try to do is illustrate which levels of government or actors have a role to play in making this happen, because it's never the Department of Health, right? It's never just one actor. It's always this constellation of actors. Funding's coming from maybe multiple sources, and you actually need a diversity of actors involved. And so just as an example here, you've got the increasing tree canopy. If I had that, oh, there it is. You've got households and parks departments, as an example, have a role to play, often as users of state or state distributed federal funds for urban forestry, often managed by the Department of Natural Resources here in Washington State. But those kind of things allow you to put trees out in neighborhoods or put trees in urban areas or along transit corridors. So that's you know, right away, you've got multiple actors involved, right? You've got the funding side, you have both private actors and public actors. And it's often not just parks departments. That's one thing. But if you're talking about your rights of way, you might be talking about your transportation department needs to be involved as well, right? They don't necessarily see their primary objective as protecting public health. And have legitimate other priorities that need to be considered, right? Public transportation is a complicated, underfunded part of sort of the public benefits of most communities as it stands. And they might be struggling just to make sure that the buses run on time. And then you come to them and say, well, you know what we want you to do is add, you know, new budget line items to build shade structures or to plant trees. And you've got to be able to get into a conversation with them about finding those new sources of funding. And that's part of the beauty of this distributed nature as well, is that there are new pots of money to tap into. The transportation department doesn't have to take this out of their core budget per se, but you could go after those urban forestry funds that wouldn't otherwise go probably to the transportation department to make that happen. But there's others, right? The emergency management division in Washington State administers FEMA grants. You know, in theory, they could make this kind of good urban forestry and increasing tree canopy part of their review of projects for funding. Commerce is providing guidance under the Growth Management Act that many municipalities are using one way or another as guidance for like what's best practice in Washington State for doing this sort of stuff. So it's not just looking at, you know, we've got a mayor and three county commissioners and the military on the panel here, but there's a lot of other actors involved as well, and there's a lot of networking between those actors that needs to happen. But then, of course, state and other local decision makers, legislators, if you will, do have a role to play, and that's the Chula Vista example is one example where they did come out with a shade tree policy where private developments were required to achieve a certain amount of shade coverage for parking lots for places that tend to get really hot, as an effort to just cool down the city as a whole and reduce the urban heat island. So there's some really great innovations out there in the world that we can mirror. And there's eight other examples of that are in the report. But the other thing that's kind of at the back end of the report, and I made sure this was at the back of the report on purpose, because I feel like this is where people tend to go to this, which is like, I want to know more, is what they're asking. And there are some legitimate reasons to want to know more, but there's so many things we could just do today that we already know how to do, that we could leverage existing opportunities through existing capital improvements plans or, you know, citizen-initiated, improvements to the transit system that could, you know, you can incorporate these public health protective measures into these things as you go. Nonetheless, there's still often really valid questions about like, well, what should we prioritize? There's limited funding, or we've got a bunch of different populations that are potentially vulnerable. You're talking about farm workers, but maybe that's not much of an issue here in Island County. I don't know, but what is the issue in Island County, right? So we've got a few different ways to gather information that are efficient and are maybe worth your staff considering. So one, this top bullet here is a tool that we created, and it's the picture on the lower left-hand side. It's a picture of this tool, the Climate Mapping for Resilient Washington tool. It just gives you, that's the chart tool. That's the wrong tool. Sorry. There is no illustration of the Climate Mapping for Resilient Washington tool because I had it back here somewhere. It's that left-hand side there. It gives you county by county data. And so you should be able to get data for Island County through that, but oops, that's not where I want to be. It'll allow you to look at how many days are we expecting to have extreme heat events here in this county. And you can just get that information if you trust us to have run and crunched the numbers. There it is. Sometimes that's information you need to make a decision. Sometimes it's just something you need to put into a grant application because they want to see that you're considering climate issues in the course of doing other kinds of work. And so this is a free resource you can go to and gather this information, make sure it's represented to make your perhaps your grant application more competitive. You can always you know, just give us a ring too at the Climate Impacts Group. We're always happy to talk about this stuff. We're trying to democratize that information at that level. At the lower left-hand side, the Climate Health and Risk Tool, this is a new tool that's recently been put out by a collaborating organization, CHANGE, the Center for Health and the Global Environment. And I helped them put this tool together. So I kind of know it pretty well, but it does, instead of at the county level, the information you get here is much more detailed. So it really looks at a lot of the factors that drive vulnerability in communities. So, you know, the proportion of population that's, you know, elderly or other risk factors like English as a second language or other things for which we can get data at the census tract level. So it depends where you are, but in most places, I think here included, it'll be a finer scale than the whole county. And you can dig in and see what is driving vulnerability for this community, right? Or it could be you want to know more about one city in Island County, not the county as a whole. And you can start picking that apart and understanding where's the vulnerability coming from. Is it being driven by a large number of perhaps retirement facilities in a certain location, or is it being driven by people with pre-existing conditions because they happen to live near, you know, an industrial zone and there's a lot of asthma or something like that, right? There's different ways people are vulnerable.
So this chart, I'm sorry, I think I misunderstood the chart, but I'm guessing I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
So this chart isn't a reflection of heat pockets. It's a reflection of vulnerabilities.
It will eventually get you to, so you can kind of, you can pick the level at which you want to understand your community. And it can just be where is, like, how bad are we in comparison to every other census tract in the state? What's
driving the color changes? That's what I'm trying to understand.
It'll change depending on the layer you choose. So there's a lot to dig into with this tool, but you can look just at what's driving vulnerability according to certain demographic factors. So you might want to just understand the demography of your community, and you can look at that piece of the tool, and the coloration will describe vulnerability that's being driven at that level.
Based on what you would have picked, this chart could look different if you picked a different vulnerability.
Exactly.
So, okay, that makes a little more sense to me because I was like, I do not understand this chart.
No, it's impossible to use as a static tool. Yeah. Right. And that's the thing, is that we're going from something easy to look at, the Climate Mapping for Resilient Washington tool, to something that's more of an interactive opportunity to really dig in and understand your community at a greater level of detail to see where that vulnerability is driven from. So, right, an example would be you might have a red county, if you get the level of like overall heat exposure, or not exposure, heat health vulnerability, like who's vulnerable to heat, and you see some maybe red zones flaring up on the east side, and there'll be some on the west side of the Cascades, right? On the east side, it might be driven more by outdoor workers, people that are working outdoors much more, and generally warmer temperatures in that area. And on the maybe, you know, sort of Seattle metro area, you'll have more populations that are poor with pre-existing conditions living near industrial zones, right? So it'd be very different reasons that people are popping up as red and vulnerable. And so the tool is designed to like allow you to dig in and understand those differences. So it's just a deeper level of understanding. The thing bottom right, that this is just a third thing that one of our collaborators did, which is in Spokane doing this. It was like a citizen science campaign where they had people put monitors on their cars and they drove all over the community at different times of day to see where is heat being retained overnight and what does it look like at peak heat during the day. And it allowed them to kind of dispel some myths in Spokane. In Spokane, the myth was that extreme heat is basically the summer version of a persistent winter problem there, which is the unhoused tend to be in a really tough spot during very cold periods of time. And so they need to open up more capacity for the houseless to have a place to stay until that extreme cold event is over. And they were thinking in that way till they did this work. And they realized that actually the people who are most vulnerable tend to own a home. They're living in it, but they're not able to afford AC. They tend to be a little older. It was a totally different demographic. And that's really allowed them to understand their vulnerability better and then do a community survey. So a lot of that took a lot of time and effort. And you can see kind of the big picture I'm getting at here is these things can take a lot of time and effort, and you can spend a lot of money doing them, and you may still not have actually improved the situation for anyone yet if you go down these rabbit holes. But sometimes you got to go down the rabbit hole, right? So here's three different levels at which you can dig down into these things and understand them better. But getting to the big picture, I guess, you know, taking some of the, like, what are some of the takeaway points? And I hope I included that one. I'll say it just because I didn't include it. It's, you should take action now if you can, right? If there's funding, if you know where your high-risk areas are, if you've got an opportunity, like a upcoming revisit of your, you know, strategic plan for transportation, and you're thinking we should have some covered, you know, bus stops, or we should maybe put trees along the you know, avenues in cities where you've got more heat, do it, you know, just do it. You don't really have to wait and do all these studies. But some of the other key points here are kind of obvious, but, you know, putting them out there for everyone. Extreme heat is deadly. A lot of people are dying because of it. In Washington State, that will continue. It'll continue to be deadly, not just because climate is changing, but because our state's population is aging. We're having more people getting older, and that means the proportion of the population is getting more vulnerable. There's greater urbanization, so there's a lot more trees getting cut down and, you know, parking lots or houses going in, so that's increasing vulnerability. And of course, climate change was a piece of the puzzle as well. It is important to focus both on long-term risk reduction as well as short-term emergency response. A lot of people get into this position where they're thinking like, oh, we've got an extreme heat event coming in like the next week or something. What do we do to prepare for it right now? And that's super important. That's how you prevent, you know, people from dying in the moment. But when you're thinking about how you reduce the urban heat island, now you're talking about thinking 10 to 30 years out. If you want to start a campaign to plant trees, those trees have to be planted and then they have to mature over the course of decades before you have meaningful reduction in heat exposure. So you have to think both long-term as well as short-term. You got to pursue a portfolio of strategies. I just presented a whole bunch of things you can do. And if you do just one of them, it's not going to make a measurable difference, right? You have to pursue this portfolio of strategies for a few reasons. One is that a lot of strategies protect one vulnerable population, but not another, right? So if you're doing something for people who are exposed to outdoor, to heat while working outdoors, that's great for them, but isn't necessarily helping people who are inside because they're, you know, maybe are mobility impaired and, you know, stuck in their, you know, nursing home or something like that. And vice versa, right? If you focus just on, you got to provide air conditioning units to people, then those people who are exposed when they're doing outdoor work, even if they had air conditioning at home, it's not going to help them when they're out in the field working on highways or you know, dealing with crops. Also, extreme heat can lead to cascading disasters. We haven't had a lot of that here, but you've probably seen it or heard of it in California. Power failures caused by fires, that kind of thing. When we have extreme heat, our chances of fires go up and electricity demand spikes. Just last week, because of the fires, you may have heard a couple of dams had to be shut down up by Diablo Lake in the Cascades, and a third of Seattle's power was unavailable for a bit. What if the extreme heat event hit right then? Right? What would that do to people's ability to use air conditioning units? So you got to think about a portfolio of strategies, because there could be that time when if you put all of your eggs in the air conditioning basket, it's not usable, and you've actually increased your vulnerability because everyone thought they were safe and they're not. And basically redundancy is crucial when lives are at stake. You know, people aren't going to be responsive to all these things. Not everyone likes to talk to the government. You probably have had a few people come and talk to you and let you know that already. But, you know, some of these populations in particular are very skeptical of speaking with government or going to a government-run facility. So you might need to work through churches or work through nonprofits, people that reach into those communities and understand them well, to really make sure we're protecting folks. And the last point I'm including here, and this is a subset of what our real takeaways, I invite you to look at the report. Just the back cover of that report, again, has all this stuff on it, so you don't even have to look at the full report. But this is the big one, I think, which is embracing this governance challenge of coordinating and empowering these diverse participants. It's fundamental to saving lives. I think at a simplistic level, before I started this work, I was like, well, obviously, Washington State Department of Health has got to be on top of this. And then as I dug into the details, I realized they have no power over the vast majority of the ideas that I just put up on the screen for y'all, right? You all actually have a lot more power here to affect things at the local level than the Washington State Department of Health has authority over, right? And so this is almost a call to think through, like, what's the opportunity around something like in Phoenix, they've developed a city heat mitigation officer, somebody who sits in the mayor's office and gets to touch all the departments and kind of coordinate response during emergencies, but also coordinate and make sure people are thinking about that long-term risk reduction as those opportunities arise. So that could be done at a city level, like what Phoenix is exploring, but I could see it being done at a state level, right? That's not where you all play a role necessarily, but maybe it opens some ideas in y'all's minds of things that can be done. And I think that's it. I just threw up the link for the report. And if you want to dig into the really gnarly peer-reviewed academic article, it's that second link. But I'm glad you had me. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Of course, no one.
So this is real basic, Dr. Vogel. So today feels really hot out there, but according to my phone, the high in Coopville is 79, which is not hot, too bad. My question for you, Dr. Vogel, is what temperature is defined as extreme heat?
That's an important point, because I think up here we hear about 116 degree weather in Phoenix and we're like, well, why are we even complaining?
Right.
But it is very much relative. And people grow accustomed to the environment in which they live, right? So I would be very cold in North Dakota, I think. But people live in North Dakota and they do just fine. There's different ways that people define this stuff, but usually we look at the total range of temperatures people experience in a given geographic area. And it's like, you know, what is the top 1% of those temperatures? And we'll above that top 1%, we'll call that extreme heat. Extreme heat in the western part of Washington, and it could vary, right? Now you can talk about it varying from weather station to weather station, but over the western Washington area, excluding the mountains, because that makes things seem artificially colder, it's like 84 degrees is the point at which we start worrying about people having severe medical complications because of the heat itself. But that's just sort of a proxy, because if you think about, yeah, it's 84 degrees, but what if you live in a three-story apartment complex with no air conditioning and you're on the third floor and so all that heat keeps pushing up and you're like, maybe you don't get the corner unit, so you only have windows on one side of your building, so you can't even get like the throughput of evening air, you could just be baking in there for days during an extreme heat event, right? So that's going maybe deeper than you were asking me
thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I do have a question. Thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome.
It is hard sometimes to coordinate efforts when responsibilities cross agencies and departments and so this is really important point for us all to consider. Have you experienced folks that are climate deniers when you've been presenting this information? So they take fault immediately with the graphs and the modeling and the predictions. And
is that one of the
big barriers?
Yeah. I honestly don't think it's a big barrier because, because I'm happy to engage with those folks. Because most of them have experienced the things that we're talking about. I'm not, you know, I have opinions about, but I'm not here to talk to you about whether you should drive an electric vehicle or whether wind energy or solar energy or coal or whatever, you know, what's best for the planet. I have opinions, but what we can get people to agree on is we don't want people to die in an extreme heat event, right? And honestly, when they did that study in Spokane, the people who showed up as most vulnerable were elderly men over the age of 65, which probably puts them solidly in a slightly redder camp than your average person in Spokane. So they're vulnerable, right, to these same events. So I think we can, at a human level, really connect with people on, you know, who are your neighbors, who's vulnerable, and how do we help them? And let's get the politics out of it. if we can.
I'm gonna pull you back into them.
Okay.
Do you use this information? Are you going to use this information to advocate for any policy changes at the state level, or you just make it available? And partly where I'm asking is, this state's a growth management state that deliberately urbanizes some areas and protects rural space in other areas, giving the privilege then to those who can afford to live in open space, protection, a little bit more protection from these heat experiences, and then taking populations of people, many of which were on your slides, and putting them more in more dense concrete environments. And we do it on purpose. But yet you're saying the chances of dying are higher in those areas where we deliberately put and intensify humans and concrete and
the whole thing.
Are you going to use this information to help educate policymakers on the fact that maybe their plan to protect the earth is not as protective as they envision?
You used two words. One was, are you going to educate these people on that? And the other was, are you going to advocate for these things? And that's where I have to draw the line, because working at the University of Washington, I technically am a state employee. So my ability to advocate for policies with other state agencies has a pretty clear limit. But I'm willing to walk right up to the toe of that line and tell people exactly what they need to hear. We do actually get invited to speak to panels of the state legislature on these topics from time to time. And we come and we let them know what our research has uncovered. And it's not always comfortable stuff, right? They've also, you know, this last legislative session had a lot of really interesting activity going on around the impacts of climate change. And, you know, before that, it was always about electric cars or electric ferries or, you know, mitigation stuff. But this last session, there's a lot on how do you deal with the impacts of these changes. And we were involved, our organization, the Climate Impacts Group, in helping kind of push some of those forward in a more, in a way that would work better, I think, for the communities that we've had the opportunity to work with, at least. Including these new requirements under the Growth Management Act to have a climate, quote unquote, climate element to your growth management plan. But that was kind of vague. What does that mean? And we wanted to make sure that some of these very specific ideas got included, right? And they're doing that. They're still evolving it. But I could go on and on, but I do want to go there, but I also want to come here, because what the state's probably going to be best at is, you know, maybe passing a reasonable law or two and then providing money, funneling federal resources sometimes, or sometimes it's state resources to local governments. But a lot of this comes down to, you know, your local land use planning is mostly locally determined, even though you're right, there's zones that are being designated at the state level, right? So you got to kind of hit all those levels. So yes, I'll talk to everybody.
I mean, I think that the fact that you have to put your jobs in certain areas and you're forcing people to drive into certain areas, you don't allow that community where you could work and walk. And I just think there's a lot of information here that speaks to the fact that our goal was achieved from one aspect in GMA and is highly destructive in another. And I would hope that there's opportunity to educate policymakers around that.
Yeah.
The question for Sean.
Sean.
Mm-hmm. So Sean, yesterday, I actually had a citizen ask me where they could find cooling stations in Island County. And besides telling them to go to the library or the grocery store, do we have other kinds of cooling stations? And do we have it advertised anywhere?
Yeah. So I think Eric is here. Eric Brooks, Director of Emergency Management. And on the DEM website, there's a list of updated, I believe, list of up-to-date cooling centers, and that's, we've been sharing that out on our social media, and I believe in Eric on DEM social media, so we maintain that as a resource for folks.
Thank you, Eric.
Any other questions? Yeah.
In your presentation, to me, it's like, you've got to involve the planners, so the city planners, county planners, they're the ones that are coming up with rules, like how big a parking lot you have. They have a look now at a bank. They don't follow the fact that, you know, banks have gone down to a utility instead of them.
Yes.
You know, and so the parking lots are based on, you know, how many employees. And it's kind of like, you should be able to reduce down the asphalt the tree was going to be put in, you know, the tension pond in that area instead of once again northern. There's a committee by the planning department in the city and the town, and, you know, to make the changes. A lot of the codes are outdated. And following what you're talking about, those are things that, you know, you can't keep putting it off, but instead you plant a tree, you can be in there for, you know, 10 years or more, but something.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's going to be put in shelters, you know, around it. The sooner you can get that into the planning department, the better. It's got a lot of good ideas. Like I said, you know, brought up the fact about the climate change denier. You're going to have that everywhere. And you've got to, you know, get through that. The fact that we all see what's going on in the climate. You've got to sign up for that. But the guys with standards and policy, and they're the ones that are dealing with the climate.
Well, here's a question you all might be able to answer for me, right? Which is, I agree that, you know, the planners need to be part of the conversation, but who can really ask them, make them think about public health, right? It's not
people right here. Well,
I mean, the good news about the timing of this presentation is that all of the communities in Island County, the municipalities and the county itself, are going into its comprehensive plan update, which then updates your policy statements. Mm-hmm. And from your updated policy statements then drives your code changes, right?
Right.
And the comprehensive plan process involves elected officials, but a lot of citizen outreach. So even if they start saying things that are broad statements about climate, it gives the opportunity then to break down the details in that plan. So the timing is perfect because we're mm-hmm. all headed into that comprehensive plan value statement update process that will then drive the code changes. So it's good timing. Yep. Every municipality, we're ready to go. You have all the problems though, so you better get on it. Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thanks very much.
And then Chris is going to come up while we have him.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We'll welcome up Chris Matochi of the Living Environments Programs and providing an overview of living environment services and programs, which include food safety, solid waste, zoonotic diseases, and do a screen share here.
And can we do a time check? So are we going till 3:30? What time is it? 2:30?
It's 2:10.
2:10, good.
I should be able to wrap up by 3.
3 o'clock. So yeah. Chris, you have plenty of time then.
Oh, I do? Okay. You shouldn't tell me that. No, I'm kidding. I'm gonna try to be as short as possible. Good afternoon, board. Thanks so much for giving me the chance to talk about our programs today. I really appreciate that. Thank you, everybody that is going to be listening to me, and I apologize in advance if this is not as exciting for you as it is for me.
That you decided to take another job. That exciting, or
that's not exciting at all. I have actually been crying in my hall.
I just wanted to like make sure that you understood that I saw that pitch come my way and I swung at it. So
okay. I'm very sad, but at the same time I'm very excited that I'm still gonna get to work with everybody that I work with right now. So I will tell you guys about some of the stuff that I'm gonna be working everybody still actually. The Living Environments Program is very exciting, and it sounds a little bit boring because a lot of people hear these words and they're like, oh my gosh, it's talking about public health, you know, and the places where people usually live. But it's much more complex than that, especially because the Living Environments Program, it's one of the very few programs that we have at Public Health where every single person that is in this room right now eventually is going to experience a problem or some sort of issue that relates to the Living Environments Program. So the Living Environments Program, it's very special too, because we do a lot of collaboration with different agencies to be able to bring some light into some of the issues that come to our desks all the time. It's very exciting because we get to meet people from other jurisdictions. We get to collaborate in solutions. We also get to get some help for resources. And a lot of times, you know, when people work together, it makes the work much better. So this is the chance that we have of being able to improve some of these areas in Island County. So the program has many programs that relate to public health environments. It covers a variety of issues. There are so many issues that we cover, and sometimes a lot of people don't know about some of the things that we do. We work with other Island County programs. We had situations where I collaborate with Department of Emergency Management. We work with planning. We work with Public Works. And sometimes we work with HR, which is another part too. But what is nice about this program as well is that we work with agencies at different levels. So we work at local, state, and federal levels. The goal of the program is to make sure that the place where people live, where they play, where they learn, they are safe spaces. We also work on promoting health. A lot of times it's very important for us to be able to understand the relationship that people, animals, and the environment where they live, you know, have, and the consequences that that it has. We always try to work on promoting the prevention of diseases before we work on remediation, because, you know, a lot of times prevention is the key. We also try to promote sanitation, make sure that the food and the water is safe where people, you know, in Island County, anywhere that they're going to go, we never stop to think about, hey, I'm drinking water. Did I ever think that this is not safe? Or if they go to a restaurant, they never stop to think like, oh my gosh, like this restaurant is not safe for me to eat right now. And a lot of times they don't know all the work that goes behind to make sure that that's the assurance that we can have here. And then we have our other areas where we also promote prevention and also health when it comes to toxics, air quality, health environment conditions all over through Island County. So this is a little picture that kind of tells you how random this program is, because there's so many areas that it covers that a lot of times they're like, oh, that's part of living environments. I didn't even know that. Or even programs where are not necessarily part of living environments, we will most likely work with them somehow. So because I know that you guys have been listening to a lot of people talk today, and I want to make this a little bit more exciting. So I'm going to ask some questions here and there that can be a quiz. And if you know the answer, feel free to reach your hand and answer. I do have some little prizes brought to you by my candy drawer in my desk. Oh, so if you want some, it's on. There are very various things. None of them are expired. I promise you that. I checked for them. So they're right here, and you can come in and grab at the end. So the first program that I'm going to talk about with you is the food safety. So the food safety is a very special program under our division, and a lot of people don't understand how crucial the work of the food program is. So I brought you two pictures from two establishments that are very, they're actually from our very own community. And when you look at that, on the picture on the left, that's actually mold. So a lot of times when you go to a restaurant, you don't think that those things are what's coming, because you see your plate beautiful and you don't understand all the things that are behind the scenes that happen that we get to see. So our work has to be taken very seriously when we're doing these enforcements or taking actions when doing inspections to prevent that this stuff doesn't end up at your table. Yes.
The Board of Health would like to know which restaurants.
So I cannot disclose that information in public, but they are all those restaurants have the inspections actually made public, so you can go and see them. But I guarantee you that the ones that are here right now, they had a lot of trouble to be able to function after that. And we did. And every time that we had situations like this, we work and we work over and over with them to make sure that, you know, if they're open, it's safe. It doesn't necessarily mean that when you go there and because they're open, it's safe, that you're not going to have a problem. Sometimes you have, you know, employees that make mistakes, procedures that are not followed. But every time that we see something like this, we have to create a whole line of action of enforcement and education to be able to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And luckily, we've been very lucky with the programs and the restaurants that we have here in Island County. And then on the right, as you can see, that's actually meat juice that's been sitting there for about 3 years. And that freezer was not working for about 3 years, but food has been sitting there for 3 years very consistently. So, you know, when you think about the food that you eat and you see this, a lot of times it's very easy for you to think about like, oh my gosh, I'll never eat at a restaurant again. We're guarantee you that, of course, there are outliers. And what I can tell you is that the majority of the establishments that I call it take their business very seriously. And sometimes things like this can happen, but we always try to work really hard to make sure that this doesn't happen. So I have a question for you. What is the number one foodborne illness risk factor in the U.S. for chocolate?
Inadequate refrigeration.
That's a good guess. Anybody else has another good guess on that? Good job. Yeah, actually, the number one for this, Commissioner Bacon, that was very close. Oh, we have many questions. Yeah, so we have one winner because I have many questions. So you might
again.
I actually can tell you if you tell me another one that might be in the list because I'm going to give you a list in a second. So she won. The first one is actually personal hygiene. So something so simple as washing your hands, you have no idea the wonders that it make, right? We are very strict about that. Actually, state works with education to make sure that, you know, we have some standards that we follow statewide. And I can tell you that personal hygiene is always top priority on the inspections. So anybody have another guess about something that can be in there? Taylor, you look very smart. Okay. Yeah, yeah, that actually can be part of it. So the top five are personal hygiene, improper holding temperatures, improper cooking temperatures, food from unsafe sources, and then the last one, which you said, actually involves contaminated equipment and cross-contamination. And, you know, again, a lot of times you don't understand the impact that it has of something so simple as not, like, we're using the same spatula for two different types of food. That can cause somebody to die, and a lot of people don't think about that. Okay, so not trying to be a Debbie Downer with food, but our food in Island County, it's safe, and we work really hard to make sure that it is. So for the food safety, what we do, we make sure that the food is going to be, you know, safe. And then we also work on permitting. We do routine inspections on those establishments. We conduct foodborne illness investigations. We make sure that all the complaints that come to our desk are followed very seriously, even though sometimes they might not be as serious as they should. A lot of times, you know, somebody will call because they had a bad experience with the customer service. And then we go there and it's like, well, that's not really food safety because we look from a health perspective. Make sure if you're going there and it's creating any risk to the health and of the population, then it becomes our issue. But a lot of times, you know, HR issues are not really stuff that we do. We then make sure we consult with establishment owners and staff. We always make sure that we try to educate them. And we are really focusing on providing a lot of outreach resources for them right now. And then we make sure that we're going to educate the industry and the public as a whole about food handling. Now, we're going to change a little bit of subject. What is the number one most littered item in the world? Anybody? That's really good. That's actually one of the top ones, but it's not it.
Beer can. I meant aluminum.
Well, yeah, especially doing festivals, that's probably true. Yes, who said that? Linda. Yes. Okay. So Linda's right. Linda, you get a chocolate too. So
I
have two sitting over here, guys. Don't grab it. What'd you say? You were at the top one. Commissioner, I promise you're gonna have your prize.
I say something and then you say you are right. Here's
your
chocolate.
Here, how about this? I'm gonna give you an honorary cereal bar right here because you are actually you said it right. So plastic bottles are there. So these are all the items that are the most litter items in the world. And some of them you kind of expect that, but some of them you're like, oh, okay. For example, like when you think about takeout containers, right? A lot of times you're like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna go there, order to go. And you don't understand it. If every single person in this island, how many people do we have total right now, as of right now in Island County around?
86,000,
right? So imagine if one night everybody decides to eat out, we have 86,000 containers that are about to be disposed. So, you know, sometimes you look at little things and you don't understand the impact that they have. Okay, so now this leads to the other program. This is actually the first program I worked at when I was when I came to Island County. It's solid waste program. This is the one that I guarantee you that is going to be the majority of complaints or concerned citizens are going to come from issues like this. So as you guys can see, those two properties, I actually am going to switch slides so it doesn't show the address there. But those two properties are actually in Island County and we work with them for several years, which also leads me to one thing that I would like to point out before we even talk about this program of how important it is. A lot of times we have to, you know, as a government agency, we have to take actions and follow procedures and do our job. And every single action that we do, you know, becomes a domino effect where it might create some other issues that we have to address in the future. So a lot of times when we talk about, you know, some of the homeless encampments, there's a very hot topic. I'm not going to get into it, I promise. But you look at a situation like that, you have to think about all the other things that we worked on that were resolved, but then ends up leading to that because we have, you know, a common problem that hasn't been addressed, which is housing. So this program is very important because we try to do as best as we can with some of the, the work that we do to make sure that we address all of those areas. But ultimately, is a program that is very important because everybody can experience that, right? Everybody having a neighborhood, a neighbor that doesn't collect trash properly or dispose of the trash properly. So a lot of times, you know, we work with this program all over the island, both Camino and Whidbey. So what would we do? We work with permits for the solid waste facilities. We review plans. We monitor environmental quality. We make sure that we investigate any type of complaints. So that includes like angry neighbors. Sometimes includes, you know, some of the businesses that are not disposing them properly. Sometimes involves the solid waste facilities that we have in Allen County that might not be doing some of their procedures properly. And then we also want to make sure they provide assistance to the community. So they have, you know, information about how to do dispose of trash properly. And then we also work, you know, with educating them about recycling, you know, about disposing of them in the locations and how they do that in a way that is much more sustainable.
Chris, before you move off of that one, how much power is in enforcement within that program right there? So we get asked lots of times, well, especially as it relates to the solid waste piece, why isn't public health enforcing? Why isn't public health red tagging? Why isn't public health evicting? How much power is within that solid waste program to compel behavioral change?
That is an incredible question. And the reason why I'm very glad that you asked that question is because that's something that gets asked to us very often. So we have regulations, right? Set of regulations that we follow. We have, you know, the WAC, we have ICC, we have our RCW that we follow. And every time that we're working on a case, what people don't understand is that coming from a public health, I have to stand within the scope of my work and say, okay, these are the things that I can legally cover. These are the things that I can legally have a code for and can back me up. And then I can make sure I can proceed enforcement. But a lot of times too, when you look at these issues, a lot of people forget about the public health aspect of those issues. So for example, I used to have a lady that I was working with in the past where her neighbor would constantly call because she didn't like the fact that she had cardboard boxes in her backyard. So the neighbor said, no, it's a health hazard. I don't like looking at it. It doesn't look good. And then she'll call. And then you end up realizing that the reason why she was calling is because she felt like the value of her home was being impacted by those card boxes from this lady that we end up working with. So when you look at a situation like that, is there a health hazard in somebody having card boxes in their backyard? They'll say, rats. I say, well, I can tell you right now, the rodents don't eat cardboard boxes. But a lot of times it can be a room for a vector. So that could be something that could be applied. And a lot of times we have a wide range of problems, right? Of something that is like absolutely detrimental to the health of Allen County. And we definitely need to make sure they're enforced, like some of the homeless encampments that we had before, because the water can be contaminated, you know, the soil can be contaminated. But the biggest challenge is that the properties that we have been successful in making sure that we do that correctly, while still being equitable and providing the resources that these people need, the biggest challenge is that it's easy to enforce when it's a private property and you have an owner that actually wants to bring the property in compliance. When those issues are in public, it brings an array of difficulties because you don't really have an owner to enforce. You have agencies that might be responsible for that piece of land. And that is a huge challenge that we have because a lot of times I have to go to somebody that lives in the situations and I have to try to enforce my job. But at the same time, I'm looking at somebody that have nowhere else to go. So then, you know, when we look at specific issues like solid waste, we try to do everything we can to provide the resources to address those issues. And I guarantee you that a lot of times when we address those issues, we realize that the issue was not actually the trash. The issue was something much bigger than it's outside of the scope of my work. But it's a really good question. So there are things that we can do, but also there are very limitations in what defines those enforcement actions that we take. So a lot of times when I say, you know, Island County is not doing anything about it. Well, Island County is doing something about it. And we have a set of regulations they can use as a backup, but there's only so far that we can push those. I don't have the authority to go to somebody, walk into their house and say, you need to dispose of this right now or we're going to kick you out. You know? So at the end of the day, we have to follow some procedures, but there's very, you know, there are legal limitations on the things that we do. That's why the cases that we have been mostly successful have been the cases that we work with them. We educate them, provide some vouchers if they're having financial problems. You know, we can go there and work with different organizations throughout Island County to provide help. And we had many places that, you know, and properties that were very successful at that. But we do still have some properties that's been going on for years because a lot of times, you know, it's a much more complicated process. So does that answer your question?
It did. Is your primary tool civil then? So financial penalties, is that?
Not necessarily. And I'll tell you that because in the 4 years that I've been here, I never had to get to that point. With all the properties that I was working on, there were high priority cases. They all end up coming to compliance and all of them came through education. We were doing outreach and visiting the property very often. It doesn't mean that we don't get there because we did have a couple of cases where we ended up pushing to the PA's office, but it's not because we're not very strict about the things that we do or don't take seriously. It's because a lot of times, you know, it's much easier to educate people and have them work with you rather than working with them, you know, against them. Because our goal is to make people understand that we're trying to work with them rather than against them, you know? And when they understand that message, it becomes much clearer because then we had situations where sometimes what I had to go to homeless encampments and I work with the owner and the owner will call me and be like, hey, I got this much trash out. Can you help me? Do you know how I can find resources to get this other portion? So anyway, but yeah, it really depends on the cases, but sometimes it's very limited in what we can do. And sometimes it's a very long process and people don't understand it takes time, especially when things become legal. It takes a long time. It's not overnight. I can go there and, you know, clean up a property in a day. It doesn't work that way. Okay. So another program, I'm going to be very brief about this one, is pollution prevention. It's a brand new program that we started a couple years ago. Huh? Yeah. And it's a very successful program because this one comes from the educational standpoint. So while the solid waste has the ability to enforce, we also have the pollution prevention assistance that actually tries to prevent everything from getting to the environment. We help businesses to make sure that they dispose of their hazardous waste properly so it doesn't end up in our waterways. We work with people that have very small businesses where they need some product replacement where they can get something that is much more sustainable and better for the environment. So we have some funding that we get from ecology that can help them to purchase better products and so on. But the biggest thing is that about this program is an educational standpoint, and we do a lot of education with some of those businesses in the community. And we've been pretty successful the majority of the time with them. When they know that we're there to help them out. Okay, question. What is a greater threat to life expectancy more than smoking, HIV, or a war? So in other words, what can kill you more than those three things? Yes? Mosquitoes. Okay, that's a good guess. Anybody else?
Dirty water.
Dirty water. Okay, that's a good guess. Anybody else? Okay, air pollution. So how fitting is that? So actually this is one of the things that can kill you. And the reason why is because in such a broad level where everybody can experience. So it's very fitting after coming Dr. Jason right before me, but actually that is a much bigger threat to life expectancy. Because if you live in an area that has really bad air quality, you end up developing all those problems. And everybody knows about that. I mean, he talks about that earlier. But I was very surprised to find that out. Okay, so that leads us to the outdoor burning and air quality program that we have. So one of the exciting things is that we just started an air quality committee, which we started meeting weekly to be able to talk about some of the issues that we have with air quality. And my coworkers that are in that group are doing some amazing work about distributing some HEPA filters to some of the community members to make sure to help them out with air quality. I'll get that on the next slide. Thank you, Sean. Okay, so we work on protecting air quality and make sure to enhance that too. But honestly, one of the major roles of this program from our perspective here, public health, environmental health, is to make sure that we regulate and enforce recreational, residential, and land clearing burns. So we respond to complaints when somebody calls and they said that the neighbor has a fire. But at the same time, if you have, you know, let's say a land clearing burn that is causing a hazard to a specific community or area, we have to make sure and step in, and we work with the fire department, we work with law enforcement to make sure that we do everything we can to protect health and safety of people. And then we also help monitoring the air quality in the region. We work with a few agencies. One of our biggest partners is the Northwest Clean Air Agency. They provide a lot of resources for us. And then we, under this program right here that we have, that we started working with the Air Quality Committee, we are trying to expand some of the work that we do working in different agencies within Island County. So we have, you know, communicable disease. We have the nurses working with us on the committee. We have some of the people from, you know, from the other programs like schools, and then even like the outdoor burning program itself. So we're going the right direction, I believe. What is the most common cause of death among children between 1 and 4?
Drowning.
Whoa, you got it. So yes, there you go. Drowning. Good job, Commissioner Johnson. So which leads me to the, and I'm getting to the end, I promise you, you're not gonna have to hear me talk for too long. This is the water recreation program. And this is a, I love this program because a lot of people don't understand some of the stuff that happens in the water. But this program makes sure that the water is safe. You know, every time you go to a public pool, and again, the word here is public. So if it's used by the public, then it becomes our jurisdiction. If it is privately, you know, the county doesn't really mind what happens in your pool. But we do inspections about water quality, about the safety, the equipment that they have there, the way that the facilities are running, inspecting the frequency that they monitor the water quality. We had some very interesting stuff that happened before in this program. And when it comes to, you know, babies and water and, you know, and some of the health issues that come with public water. But we work really hard to make sure that those facilities are up to date with all the measures that they have to take to prevent diseases. And then we also have this school health and safety program. So this one is another one that is a crucial program to our Living Environments Division that helps a lot of children out there. So the best way for us to be able to talk about it is, so you have L&I for adults and workers, and then you have public health school safety for children. So pretty much the L&I for children, we're there to advocate for them. And every time that we go these inspections, we have to look from the perspective of a child, right? So you go to a classroom and you look in there and you say, okay, there's absolutely no hazards here. And then when you look around, you find wires, you find a lot of, one of the things that we find a lot too, we have some of those essential oils diffusers that go to the classrooms. It's just like, what's the problem here? It's great. It smells like lavender. I mean, children love lavender, but then they realize that sometimes there are children that might be deadly, you know, allergic to lavender. So we have like little things like that. Sometimes they think that we are the evil, but in reality, we're always thinking again from like a two-year-old perspective of like how everything can be dangerous. What is the leading cause? Oh, yeah.
Does school health and safety include daycare, childcare facilities, or just public schools?
So K through 12. And it could be private and public schools. Yeah. So anything earlier than K usually is regulated by state. So the state has a school safety program that they regulate those facilities. However, we do still provide some resource. And if they call us with some, you know, they have some questions or they need some sort of materials for education, we always provide that for them. We just don't do the inspections on them.
For food safety, I hate to drop back there.
Oh, no problem.
How does that work? Does public health do food safety inspections on the Navy base, or you have your own public health officers that do that?
We have our own public health department on base, and my staff at the hospital actually goes out and for the restaurants on base.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually that's a very good question, because we have a few of our programs that we work in conjunction with the base. We have some of the nurses that we work there, some of the APPEs that they do an incredible job where we work together in some of the cases, because a lot of times they are much broader than just being at the base, and they're much broader than just being outside of the base. So a lot of times you have people that, you know, they live lives and work in those different places. So it involves both, and that's when we coordinate with them a lot in some of those cases.
Great.
What is the leading cause of human rabies deaths in the U.S.? In other words, what is the most common vector on this one?
Bats.
Yes, yeah. And you're from the south end, so you probably hear this a lot too. Yeah. So absolutely right. So those are bats. Wait, although any mammal can really transmit rabies, and people don't understand that sometimes. But again, because they can transmit rabies doesn't mean that every single bat has rabies. So I'm glad that I'm having this chance right now, because we get a lot of calls. Every time somebody sees a bat, they want us to test because they think the bat, you know, is radioactive. But in reality, not all of them are bad. So, you know, the rabies fall under a zoonotic diseases program. And it involves a variety of things, but the most common ones are dog bites. So anybody that gets a dog bite, whether, you know, they are not from here and they're visiting and but it happens in Island County, or if it is with a resident of Island County somewhere else, I guarantee you that dog bite report is going to be at our desk, because the hospital is going to be able to submit to us. It should. Sometimes it doesn't happen. We have to chase people, but most of the time they do a really good job in letting us know. With the dog bites, a lot of people think, and they're afraid when they get a call from public health, because they think they were going to ask them to put the animal down. But the reality is, we just have to do an investigation and make sure that the animal has all the vaccinations that they need. We have to make sure that the owner is going to monitor them after they receive the bite, which, you know, a lot of times becomes a little bit more sensitive, because they think that we're going to, it's like, oh, if I tell you about, if I answer the phone, that you're going to tell me to put my dog down. And it's not how it works. You just have a few measures that I have to do. Sometimes we have situations where you got to that, but it's a much bigger issue that requires a lot of times, you know, our public health officer to intervene. And then besides the animal bites, we have, you know, we have West Nile virus, which is a program that we kind of brought back to our division again. This one is mostly done from a state level, and they use local health jurisdictions to monitor. It seems like this year they pick only a few counties from different regions. So you're using a bigger region instead of like every county that could apply. And that would do rodents and obviously avian flu as well too.
So the mosquito houses, are they for the West Nile virus?
So there's a few. So we have programs that they monitor from the Asian wasps that we had a big problem when they started coming to the state of Washington. Some of them monitor for West Nile virus. And I think that they do for, I'm not sure about the other ones, but they do have different sections within mosquitoes that they monitor different diseases. We did have a couple of calls. And Megan, what was the call that you got recently? A malaria, yeah. Yeah, so people usually travel outside, but the first thing when they get those calls, we have to look at all those aspects, because you want to make sure that it's not here. But we see them everywhere, and some of them can be from Fish and Wildlife, some of them can be from DOH, from the programs that they have. It doesn't necessarily come from us, but the traps that we set last year for the program when we were selected to run last year was specifically for West Nile virus. Okay. What is the most common type of recreational water illness? So in other words, what is the symptom that most people experience when they get sick from water?
Giardia.
That's a good guess. The water. Symptom. Yeah. So Giardia is a disease, but diarrhea. Symptom. Yeah. Somebody said it. What is it? What did you say? Well, did you say diarrhea earlier?
Oh, no.
Oh, don't see this.
Well, you're right. That is the most common one. So a lot of times when you have that symptom, good job. When you have that symptom, you know, it's one of the most common indicators that you are sick. So another common symptoms of recreational water illness is vomiting, stomach cramps, loss of appetite, weight loss, fever, and some of them can cause skin, ear, eye rashes, and other respiratory and neurological problems. So beach swim. We pretty much just monitor the water quality for all the places, for all the beaches where people recreate. And then additionally to that, besides sending all the samples and all that, we have to make sure that we post the signage when some of those samples come out of the, or, you know, out of the standards. And then we have to make sure that we inform the public. But again, we don't have legally the authority to shut down beaches. We have the authority to educate people and put signs in there to make sure that they are aware that there are some problems that can occur if they swim in there at that time because of the way the water is at that time. There's actually Matt Farr. He works on the beach and the shellfish program. So he does a lot of the testing right now. I just put a picture there because he always looks cool when he's on the get up there. We're getting to the end. What two shellfish species in Island County retain toxics longer than others?
Mussels.
Good guess. Oh, yes. Nice job. That's it. Oh, oh my God. He's cheating. That's a good guess. Ryan, that's a good guess, cheating. Though. What's his talk? Butter and varnish clams. Nice job. So I'm assuming that this is probably the last question. So it's good that you told me that now. So this is just for educational purposes. When you look at those two aquariums right there on the left, is what the water looks like without any shellfish in it. And on the right is what it looks like with all the shellfish in it. So if you look at the water, you're like, oh my gosh, so much better. Let's get a lot of shellfish in the water. Look how great it looks. The problem is that when you're eating those little beings that are sucking all of those things from the water, they have to go somewhere and they're probably in them. So a lot of times I'm not telling you to be scared or never eat shellfish, but I'm just to give you an idea of how important it is first, make sure you monitor the water quality when people are harvesting them. And that's why a lot of times when we have to tell people, hey, this is not an area where we should be harvesting, they get really upset. These is what the things that we have in mind from our perspective at public health. And we're like, hey, you might get sick. You know, the likelihood of you getting sick is very high right now. And they're like, I'm fine. I've been doing this my entire life. So I was like, okay, but at least we know that that's something that could happen, you know? And this is pretty much some of the stuff that we do. We make sure we post signs in there. We let the public know when there's danger. And again, you know, we work very closely with DOH and Fish and Wildlife to make sure that we have several jurisdictions understanding the problem so we all can help and see what is the best solution at that time. And if you're ever curious about some of those areas, we have our website is actually very updated, DOH. We have a link through the DOH website, but it's updated very regularly. All the testing that we do goes up as soon as, you know, they process the testing in the labs. So if anybody has any type of questions, you can always call us and we make sure that we help you out with that. Again, just make sure that everything is safe. We coordinate beach posting. We also make sure that we monitor for biotoxins, pollution closures, and we also make sure that we investigate to complaints. And that was it. So thanks so much, you guys, for reviving those minutes of me talking. And there's still a lot of stuff left here, again, brought to you by my desk. So if you have any questions, you can also get Candy for questions.
Jill wants to win one more. She's going to tell us the difference between the butter clam and the varnish.
One's got a shinier shell. The varnish clam. I know he doesn't. That's the answer then. He doesn't know.
Them are really hard to identify just by looking at them, right?
No, I thought varnish might be the shell. Yeah, I don't have an answer.
So I have a question. Back to your way back in the beginning, you talked about inspecting a restaurant.
Yeah.
So I assume that you do that without notifying them ahead of time. You're coming.
Absolutely, yeah. So the inspections have to be at random. And it really depends. So we ideally, our program wants to inspect every single establishment at least once a year. And then depending on the high risk of the restaurant. And again, ideally, if we had the full staff and have a lot of people that can work, because think about this, we have as of right now, 375 restaurants in Island County. And if with one person taking one restaurant a day, only one restaurant a day, you take over, you know, you couldn't finish all of them in a year. And that's, you know, and then you're also including weekends when we have festivals and we have to inspect all the foods from temporary permits and mobile units. But ideally, we want to inspect every restaurant at least once a year. And those inspections, when they are routine inspections, they come at random. So we just show up, you know, and say, okay, we're going to go there, we're going to inspect this place. But most of the time, those the hierarchy of choosing those restaurants come based on complaints or people reporting symptoms. So I can tell you right now, if anybody calls and said they got sick, we respond within 24 hours if they have symptoms. Now, if somebody calls because they say, I think they might be doing this in their back. I think that this happened. The lady was rude to me at the front desk. Those are the ones who takes, you know, we try to respond within 48 hours, but the other ones we respond within 24 hours. They can't. I mean, if we never really had a situation, and I think it's really about how you approach them too. I'm very lucky that I have a really good relationship with the restaurant owners, where they understand our purpose. Doesn't mean that it's very consistent when that's going to happen. Sometimes I have establishments that might feel attacked because you're trying to go there and, you know, and these people have been doing this for some of them their entire lives, you know, and it's really hard sometimes when you've been doing this your entire life and you have somebody coming in like, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do this. This is not how you do. And they're like, hey, my mom taught me how to do this. You know, so that's why sometimes it comes from the empathy place where you have to work with them and educate them on why those things are necessary. But yeah, we have, you know, we've seen all the spectrum of them. And most of the time, you know, even with the harder situations, when it got to the situation where we have to close them down, they understand, because, you know, you always have to explain why, and we have regulations that can back it up. We can never just say, I'm going to shut it down because you're not safe. I'm going to have to tell them why. And I have evidence, empirical evidence of the inspection, and everything's documented. So, yeah.
Any other questions for Chris?
No, you guys do a lot of really important work.
It's very random. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And, you know, I'm very lucky that I got to get a little bit of knowledge from all those programs, because, you know, there's so much that go into them that a lot of times people don't know about. And sometimes, you know, they think that when they call us, they, you know, we're sitting there waiting for their call. But a lot of times we're busy talking to people about other different issues. So, and I'm very lucky with the people that I work. So
the complaints, do people call public health directly to complain, or are those complaints go through planning department complaint?
The majority of people, they call us directly, but a lot of times that we get some referrals, or if they follow the complaint online and it relates to our division, we work with them. I work with planning all the time, especially with some of the other issues. So for example, like when we talk about solid waste, the majority of the time when you have a property that has a solid waste problem, they also have a problem with people living there. They also have a problem with the water. They also have a problem. So a lot of times when you go there and they have received the same complaint, we just join together and try to do an inspection work with the owner to address all of those problems at once, rather than having all the several visits coming in randomly, you know. But sometimes you get the complaints when people file online. A lot of times they call our front desk, and sometimes they just Google the department and their call comes straight up our phone. Sometimes it's just like, oh, you know, and they're like, oh, and you're not even ready for that. But, you know, you have to do this job and be comfortable with answering those questions on the go. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's just that I was under the impression that the complaints for all of those three departments, the three permit departments, that the complaints were funneled through the code enforcement officer, you know, who looks at the complaints online. Yeah. And then that the complaints then were moved from him to whichever group had to do that. So that was, yes. I guess, maybe it's my misperception.
No, but for the planning division, they do. Sadly, a lot of times people just show up on the front desk, and, you know, if our code enforcement officer, Mike Beach, is not there, sometimes they end up getting somebody else. But the idea is that everything going through him, he's going to be able to know what it falls within his jurisdiction or not. In our department, we're trying to assign that role specifically for living environment, so that person can deal with, and we've been talking a lot about developing some plans for that, where we have a person specifically to receive those complaints and then assign them. But with planning, a lot, that was ideally what the procedure should be like. But a lot of times, you know, people don't know about that because it's fairly new, especially with the online forms that they have to fill out. But the thing is that I know that Mike Beach does a really good job at this, but a lot of times when we get calls, we might not be the first person they're calling. They already called 3-4 people before us to try to get the answer. So I cannot look at a person and say, hey, you know, unfortunately, you're going to have to go online and fill out. I don't think that, you know, that's the best option for somebody that has 5 calls already. And they're like, I'm trying to find the answer. And even if I don't have the answer, I think it's nice sometimes to take the time and take that complaint. It's quicker.
Chris, thank you. You've done a lot of good work for us.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm going to resist the urge to ask you what type of job could possibly be better than the one you have.
None. No, it's, you know, I'm just going a different direction. I'm working a little bit more in the communications aspect of public health. So I just wanted to make sure that I get that experience, you know, sometime before I die.
We're excited for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm very lucky to be here. So thank you. Look
forward to having you back someday.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. And I'm going to leave this year, so you guys.
Oh, yeah. And Megan, you're going to give us an update on, I don't even know, and fall immunizations. See, Aurora? Anybody know what that is?
Candida auris. It's a fun one. And I apologize up front. I did not bring candy.
It's okay.
So I'm so sorry. Okay. first of all, I want to introduce myself. My name is Megan Works, and I am the community and family health manager for Island County Public Health. I'm just going to do a quick update. I know we're getting short on time, so I just kind of want to address this. Since our last Board of Health meeting, in July, there was the very first case of locally acquired Candida auris documented in a Pierce County resident. This person was hospitalized in Tacoma and then transferred to a facility in Kirkland in Seattle. And upon admission during their routine screening, a lot of long-term care facilities do screen for this routinely. It was caught and found and addressed. So first, I just want to say what Candida auris is. It's a type of yeast that can cause severe illness, especially in those suffering from serious medical conditions or people who have spent had lengthy stays in hospitals, particularly ICUs or in nursing homes. And the ones that are most affected by it, again, are people who have been in the hospital a long time, people who have had invasive lines for a long period of time. So that would be central lines, IVs, any type of catheter placed, or who have a weakened immune system. They are the most at risk. I just want to reiterate that the general public, people who are healthy, who are not spending a lot of time in the hospital, healthcare workers, the risk to them is extremely, extremely low. So I just mainly wanted to touch base to let you guys know that it's something we are keeping track of and watching. And at this point, isn't a huge concern. The other thing I wanted to talk about today is it's August, and much to the dismay of our children, it's almost time to go back to school. So because of that, we really want to reiterate the importance of this is a good time to start looking into getting those routine vaccinations up to date. Public health, on our website, there's a couple resources for parents that they can look at to see where they can go to get them in Island County. And I included those in your packet for you to look at. We are also participating in the DOH Caravan. The DOH Caravan is a mobile unit that comes and does free childhood immunizations. They've already been to a couple locations in Island County earlier in the summer. And then they're coming back August 31st to Oak Harbor and Coopville. There's a QR code that parents can scan and this is on our website also. They can register or they can just walk up also. So it's a good option. I know getting into a doctor this time of year isn't always easy. So if you're needing those last minute immunizations before school, it's a great opportunity and it's free. And I also wanted to give a couple of resources for parents who may have questions about vaccines, what their child needs about vaccine safety. There's a great resource that I found when looking into all this. It's through the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And they have a wonderful, wonderful website. It's the Vaccine Education Center. It's great. There's a plethora of information on vaccines, everything from ingredients to recommended schedules to safety, and just answers basically every question that I've ever been posed from a parent who rightfully so wants to know everything they can. And it's a great resource and I highly recommend it. And that's about it. Any questions?
What was the resource again? Children's Hospital of
Philadelphia.
See, I make up my own thing.
Yes.
Are there any other questions?
No, thank you for including this information about these two clinics on August 31st.
Yes.
Thank you. Will you send out a gov delivery about that?
We can, yes.
Okay. Vaccines are or are not required to go to school anymore.
They are required unless you have an exemption.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So there's still an element of parental choice in there that would require some engagement on it around education or issues.
Correct.
As it relates to some parental fear.
Correct.
I'm not saying the fear is misplaced. It just.
Okay. Right. And there's different routes you can take to that. And the school nurses are usually your best resource for that.
Okay.
They kind of know those more ins and outs more than I would. And that's something I would get more information for you on. But yes, there are ways for exemptions.
Why is South Whitby not on?
So they had one on for the caravan or for the any of them? So that's a great question. I believe the caravan was in Langley earlier in the summer. So that was one thing. But as far as where they can go, I believe they can go to any, Freeland is on here. The Whitby Health Primary Clinic is one of the, you can get childhood vaccines as well as pediatric associates in Freeland as well.
Right. And then we have Skagit Hospital for Camino.
Correct.
So yes, every parent has access to vaccines for their children.
That's right.
Here we go. All right. Sean, do you have anything else?
Nothing else for me.
Do we have any board member comments? How do we feel about the adjourning? I don't know that we need a motion in a second. I think we just do it, but we have one from Bob and a second from Melanie and a bunch of head nods to my right. So I think we're done. Great meeting. Thank you. We learned a lot.
Thanks, everyone.
I'm glad you joined us, Bob.